This is Yaron Brook, guest speaking on Dr. Leonard Peikoff's podcast. I'm here to apply Ayn Rand's philosophy of objectivism to your real-life questions. Your real-life questions specifically to current events, including politics, economics, and foreign policy. My answers are posted every other week on Mondays. Leonard will continue to answer questions, but now only on alternate Mondays. You can listen to full episodes on iTunes or listen to single questions or full episodes at www.peikoff.com. If you have a question to ask me, simply go to peikoff.com/questions. Okay, so this is a question about how one would transition from a mixed economy to a laissez-faire free market. And in the question, it says to return to a laissez-faire, but I don't think we ever were a laissez-faire free market. How is the transition from mixed economy to a laissez-faire free market going to happen? How should it happen? And I think it's both going to happen and I think it should happen gradually. I don't think there's any other way around it. Because if you understand the role of ideas, you understand that to start the transition towards laissez-faire capitalism, ideas are going to have to change, but ideas don't change all at once. You don't convince a majority suddenly that laissez-faire capitalism is better than other stuff. You keep pushing for laissez-faire capitalism. And it gains a bigger voice in the culture, and more people are open to it and therefore willing once in a while to vote for slightly more capitalist politicians who then start deregulating and start reducing state involvement, which leads to positive consequences, which we as advocates for laissez-faire capitalism say, see, this is what we mean and this is what is needed. We need more of this. We need to push more. And you convince more people, and more people are now voting for pro-capitalist politicians, and then there's an intensified effort towards laissez-faire capitalism. And one day we'll all wake up and, yes, a significant proportion of the population is convinced. And they only elect pro-laissez-faire capitalists. And then there's the big push at the end to do away with the last remnants of the regulatory entitlement state, and it all just disappears. But there's no way to transition from a altruistic, religious, mixed economy state to a self-interested, rational, reason-loving, laissez-faire capitalism culture in one instant. It's not going to happen that way. These are going to be small steps. Reason, appreciation for reason will gain and become more and more and more dominant, with it a respect for self-interest and individualism. And as a consequence of that, greater and greater respect for economic freedom, which will lead gradually towards laissez-faire. I think that's how it will happen. You know, I can't get elected to become president so I can flip that switch. But even if I was elected tomorrow to become president, I'd still have to convince people to flip the switch. And most people don't want to flip the switch to laissez-faire capitalism. So it's going to have to be gradual. You're going to have to phase out regulations, phase out taxes, phase out controls, phase out, in this case, the discussion is about taxi medallions, phase out taxi medallions. And how you exactly do that? In every area, you would have to think it through, figure out how to do it. What are the consequences? What are the rights involved? What are the expectations? And in every case, you would have to figure out a best method to do it. In some cases, you could just flip a switch and get rid of it. In other cases, you would have to phase stuff out. It's also important when you undo regulation to figure out which regulation comes first, which is more important to do away with, because if you do away with some regulations but not others, you could make the situation worse in the short run or in the long run. So it's a complicated – the whole process of transitioning to laissez-faire is complicated, needs a lot of thought and work, but it is a transition. There's no way culturally or politically to be just a one-time quick thing. And it's also hard to deregulate some parts of the economy, not others. And I don't think you would get to the position. I mean, how are you going to get rid of medallions and taxis in New York without people having to reconceive what private property actually means and what regulations mean and what monopoly power means and why taxis shouldn't have this monopolistic power in New York? You'd have to at the same time get rid of rent control, and because the culture will have changed and will demand all these things be gotten rid of, and you'd have to have a plan for all of them. But even if it's transition, it could be a pretty quick transition. It doesn't have to be a slow transition. So do I think it's wrong to exclude student loan debt from bankruptcy? Yeah. I mean, I think all debt should be in play in bankruptcy. I don't think you should exclude anything, mortgages, student loans. And I think all assets are in play in bankruptcy. So, for example, a lot of states have excluded your home from in play in bankruptcy. So you have certain liabilities, you have certain assets. You should have to liquidate your assets to pay for your liabilities. And that should include your home, and you should include – so the whole bankruptcy laws have been structured to favor the people in debt. And that creates huge moral hazard and creates huge economic distortions. And it's morally wrong. So what you need is an objective view of bankruptcy that treats debtors and creditors fairly and treats them right. And you need a system of law that really thinks through objectively what is the role of bankruptcy, what is its purpose. Basically, it's a recognition, again, of a certain type of contract and what happens when you can't pay your debts and how that gets arbitrated. And it's a complicated area of the law that needs legal philosophers to really think it through. But there's no question in my mind that we've gone way, way over towards overly protecting debtors at the expense of creditors. Remember that in the 19th century, there was debtor prison. If you couldn't pay your debt, you went to prison. That might be too much on the other side, but indentured servitude. So you went into basically slavery until you paid off all your debts. That might be too much on the creditor side, but today you can walk away from everything with no consequence on future earnings. No, you can't. You can hide your home. You can do this and you can do that. So I think we have to have an objective balance. Where that balance is exactly, not my job. That's for philosophers of law to figure out. But there definitely has to be some balance within bankruptcy. Okay, see, here's a kind of an interesting question. Okay, so the premise is this. So today, you know, we as objectivists often say, when financial crisis is blamed on capitalism, we say, wait a minute, you can't blame it on capitalism. We never had capitalism. We had a mixed economy. So you can't blame this on capitalism when it was a mixed economy. It's a mixed economy that led to financial crisis. The question is, why can't you say that about communism? We as objectivists always say, see, communism failed. And the people who support communism say, wait a minute. Communism's never been tried. It's a mixture. It wasn't pure communism. So there are a number of flaws with this analogy. One is, it was communism. That's exactly what communism looks like. What Stalin and Lenin did is communism. It failed. It wasn't a mixed economy. There was no freedom to be mixed in there. There was zero freedom. It's exactly what communism was. Mao tried it. The Khmer Rouge tried it. Different people have tried slight variations. They all failed. But the more fundamental issue is not that they failed. The fundamental issue is that they're evil, that they're wrong, that they're anti-human nature, that they're unethical, immoral, and therefore they have to fail. They're incompatible with human nature. They're incompatible with morality. That's the fundamental argument against communism. Objectivism doesn't say communism is bad because it doesn't work. Objectivism says communism doesn't work because it's immoral. It doesn't work because it contradicts human nature, because it contradicts reality, because it's anti-reason, because it's anti-life, because it's anti the individual. That's why it's wrong. And hey, yeah, of course it fails. And on the flip side, objectivism doesn't say capitalism is good because it works. It works because it's good. Capitalism is good because it's pro-reason, therefore pro-individual mind, therefore pro-individual human life. That's why it's good. And that's why it works. It works because it's pro-life. And yeah, then you can take examples from history. To the extent capitalism works, even with the financial crisis, life under capitalism is pretty damn good. Materially, right? Even in the 21st century, because we still have enough elements of freedom, so materially we live pretty good lives. Communism, by whatever degree you try it at, doesn't work. It fails. And when it's driven to extreme, it fails even more. So it's a direct correlation between how much freedom versus how much oppression, how much capitalism versus how much communism you have. But again, the fundamental is the moral philosophical point. And it turns out, not surprising if you understand the objectivist morality, that's how it plays out in reality. When you have a system consistent with human nature, with the requirements of human life, with morality, it succeeds. It succeeds to the extent that it's tried. So the more capitalism you have, i.e. the less state intervention, the less state involvement, the more successful a country is economically. The more communism you have, that is, the less freedom you have, the less private property you have, the greater the failure. Those correlations are throughout history, and they reinforce the moral philosophical idea. So what do we say about the fact that we benefit enormously from a lot of stuff that government does do? So, I don't know, we all went to public schools and the government funds those public schools. So, you know, whatever education we have, I went, you know, to this day, there's some weirdo on YouTube, a few of my videos he puts down, well, Yaron has never come clean because he benefited enormously from going to public school, and he went to the University of Texas, which is a public university, and he went to the Technion, which is the Israeli Institute of Technology, and that's a public institution. So he's a hypocrite because he went to all these public institutions and he's benefited from them. So what do we say about that? Or the fact that Elon Musk builds these wonderful innovations, but he's really, you know, he's really being subsidized by the government, and yet we're going to benefit from what he's done. Or what about, I don't know, maybe your grandfather was on food stamps, and the reason you're alive today is because he was kept alive because of those food stamps. So the first point is a moral point. Even whatever benefit you got from those things, and we do, doesn't justify the rights that were violated in order to give you those benefits. So you have to say, yeah, I benefited from the University of Texas, and I support its privatization and the elimination of public funding of education. Now, when it comes to me personally about how I can justify attending these schools, oh my God, I've paid more taxes to send many, many, many people into, you know, so I paid my dues, I paid my tuition, I paid all of that. They've stolen my money. Plus, what did they really steal from me? By having those institutions, and all of you, by having those institutions, they've stolen from me a free society in which I could have thrived 10x what I've done today. The quality of my education would have been far better if there was no public education. The wealth in the world today would have been 100 times greater if the government had stuck to its role of protecting individual rights instead of getting into all these other fields. My life would be so much better if government did not fund public education, public higher education, all Tesla, food stamps. That the little benefit I might get from driving on the roads and from attending public schools is a small compensation for the damage that has been inflicted on me for all of that. It is hard to imagine how much better the world would be, how much more wealth, more innovation, more prosperity, more happiness, more spiritual values, more great music, great movies, great art, in addition to all the great products we would have. And the wonderful homes and, you know, who knows, the colonies and Mars and elsewhere that we would have today, if not for the government preventing us from doing that in the name of the little benefits, the crumbs they throw us here and there in the few examples that we get here. So we are the victims of government. The little benefits we get are minutia of what we could have. Now, the only sense in which we truly benefit from government is that they do their job properly. They protect our borders from bad guys, and they catch crooks and thieves and so on. But even there, we know how distorted it is. And even there, we know how the government is wasting our money and our lives and our time building democracies overseas and housing millions of people in jail who are committed so-called or victimless so-called crimes. So, even when it's supposedly doing its proper function, it's doing it badly. So our lives is made a lot worse by the so-called good that government does to us.
If you want to know more about Ayn Rand's philosophy, I invite you to ask me a question. I can't answer them all, but I do read them all. Just write to leonard@peekoff.com. And if you haven't already done so, start by reading Ayn Rand's two most important novels, The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. And I might add that it wouldn't hurt you to read my latest book, The Dim Hypothesis.